and listen wherever you'd like. We breathe words into your life.
Welcome to the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is May 5th. Your readers are Joe McFeeters and Kent Miner. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by going to our website, ncreadingservice.org. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. We'll be reading from USA Today, starting with news, followed by money, sports, and life sections. At 8:30, our feature program will be drug and department store ads.
TV listings for tonight. On ABC at 8 o'clock, American Idol, 816, Judges Song Contest. The top eight perform songs secretly selected by Luke Bryan, Lionel Richie, or Carrie Underwood. At 10 o'clock, Paradise in the Palaces of Crowned Kings. On CBS at 8 o'clock, The Neighborhood. Welcome to Pomp and Circumstance. Welcome to Venice. At 9 o'clock, NCIS, Nexus. NCIS investigates a dangerous connection between the Nexus cartel and mob boss Carla Mariano. At 10 o'clock, Watson, Teeth Marks. Watson and the team help a woman whose memory resets every 3 minutes. On Fox at 8 o'clock, America's Most Wanted Missing Persons. People don't just disappear. At 9 o'clock, another episode of America's Most Wanted, FBI Top 10 Fugitives. And at 10 o'clock, WRAL's 10 o'clock news on Fox 50. On NBC at 8 o'clock, The Voice, The Playoffs, Part 2. The coaches enlist the help of superstar advisors as the remaining artists compete to advance. At 10 o'clock, Yes, Chef, Martha's Roast. The chefs prepare 5 appetizers, one at a time, as a team to go with Martha's Roast Chicken. On ION at 8 o'clock, FBI, Short Squeeze. A man is killed while surrounded by protesters. Another episode of FBI at 9 o'clock, Trigger Effect. The team scrambles after a mass casualty incident. And at 10 o'clock, a third episode of FBI, Straight Flushed. Five men are gunned down at a trendy New York restaurant. On PBS at 8 o'clock, Antiques Roadshow. Celebrating Asian Pacific heritage. A Hawaiian Kuau bowl. A Gandhi presentation spinning wheel. At 9 o'clock, another episode of Antiques Roadshow, Santa Clara Hour 3, Booker T. Washington Archive, Chinese Transitional Wine Pot. And at 10 o'clock, Independent Lens, Matter of Mind, My Alzheimer's, 3 Families Confront the Challenges of Alzheimer's. On MNT at 8 o'clock, Dateline, The Capture. At 9 o'clock, Law and Order SVU, Devastating Story. Another episode of Law & Order SVU at 10, Granting Immunity. On CW at 8 o'clock, All-American Award Tour. At 9 o'clock, Trivial Pursuit, Bar Trivia. At 10 o'clock, the National News Desk. And at 10:30, another episode of the National News Desk. On A&E at 8 o'clock, actually running from 8 o'clock through 9:30 are episodes of Live PD Police Patrol. At 10 o'clock, it's Florida. I'm assuming it's also, again, Live PD, but it's placed in Florida at 10 and 10:30. On AMC at 8 o'clock, a 3-star movie, The Fifth Element, made in 1997 with Gary Oldman, Ian Holm, Bruce Willis. A New York City cab driver tries to save 2,259 Earth from impact with an onrushing anti-life force. On BET at 8 o'clock, The Chi, Oh Girl. At 9 o'clock, Crime, Shawana King. At 10 o'clock, Crime, Candace Martinez. on the Disney Channel at 8 o'clock, Big City Greens at 8:30, Big City 100, 9 o'clock, Stu Go, 9:30, Kith, 10 o'clock, Jesse, A Close Shave, and another episode of Jesse at 10:30. On the Discovery Channel at 8 o'clock, Contraband Seized at the Border, Grinding to a Halt. Another episode of Contraband Seized at the Border. At 9, Grandma's Day Out. And a final episode of Contraband Seized at the Border. At 10 o'clock, Deadly Cargo. On Nickelodeon, all night long from 8 o'clock and through 10:30 are episodes of Friends. On TNT at 7:30, it's NBA basketball first round. Teams to be announced, professional basketball action from the NBA. And then that goes to about 10 o'clock, and then they'll have another set of teams in the NBA basketball first round. On USA at 8 o'clock, it's and going through to 10:30 are episodes of Law and Order SVU Victims Unit.
You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their families, and communities by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. In addition to our specially tuned subchannel radio receivers, NCRS streams our programming at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Listen by using the Listen Live streaming audio player located at the upper right-hand corner of our website pages. If you have an assistive technology device such as Alexa or Google Home, just say, "Tune in NC Reading Service" to listen instantly. We also provide podcasts of over 50 magazines and other information and entertainment programs following their initial broadcast. Again, please go to ncreadingservice.org and click on Skip to Podcast section. For more information about your North Carolina Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. From Disability Rights North Carolina, or DRNC for short, "Our work is threatened. Can we count on you so our community can continue to count on us?" Did you know this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Protection and Advocacy PNA Network? As North Carolina's designated PNA, Disability Rights North Carolina has proudly carried out our federally mandated mission, protecting and advocating for the rights of people with disabilities across our state. Funding cuts threaten the services and protections we provide to individuals with disabilities and those who love and care for them. This isn't just a budget line. This is about real people losing access to education, health care, safe housing, and the support they need to live with dignity and independence. We are proud of what we've accomplished, but we cannot continue this work without your support. We urge you to act now to protect the rights and safety of disabled North Carolinians. Together, we've built something powerful over the last 50 years. Let's make sure it lasts for the next 50 and beyond. To find out how you can help, please go to our website, disabilityrightsnc.org/take-action/. Affordable and accessible housing. Know your rights. Join the Triangle Disability Awareness Council for a seminar about affordable and accessible housing and the rights of people with disabilities. This seminar is for tenants as well as landlords and housing providers and will be held in person and on Zoom. Speaker Michael Manset, lead attorney for Fair Housing Project Legal Aid of North Carolina, will cover affordable and accessible housing, homeownership and rental, landlord and tenant rights, and reasonable accommodation versus modification. There will be plenty of time for Q&A. The event will be held on May 7, this Wednesday, from 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. in person at 2501 Homestead Road, Room 109, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and on Zoom. Link will be provided at registration. You can register by going to triangledac.org/DAC event /affordable-and-accessible-housing/. For more information, call DTAC at 919-245-4337 or email info@triangledac.org or visit their website, triangledac.org. Reasonable accommodation upon request. Have you gotten your free currency reader yet? The Department of the Treasury's Bureau of Engraving and Printing is now providing a free currency reader to all eligible blind or visually impaired individuals. The device is small, compact, and runs on a AAA battery, which is included. To use the currency reader, simply insert a U.S. bill into the reader and press the button. The device will tell the note's denomination. To request your currency reader, fill out an application form, which is available to download at BEP.gov. It must be signed by a competent authority, such as a doctor, who can certify your eligibility. Then simply mail it to the address on the application. Once your application is verified, a reader will be mailed to you at no charge. For more information about the U.S. Currency Reader Program, visit B as in Baker, E as in Edward, P as in Paul, .gov, or call toll-free 844-815-9388. Local plays with audio description. In Greensboro, Saturday, May 10, Back to the Future at 2 p.m. And that's at the Tanger Center, 300 North Elm Street, Greensboro. Call 336-333-6500. Also, Back to the Future will be appearing at 1 p.m. on Sunday, May 11. Tactile tours are available at the North Carolina Museum of Art. These tours are designed for visitors who are blind or have low vision. These docent-led tours explore the museum's collection through audio description, tactile experiences, and by engaging the senses. Tours are available by request only. You must arrange them at least 2 weeks in advance. To schedule a tactile tour, please contact Accessibility Coordinator Molly Hull at mhull@ncartmuseum.org or call 919-664-6854. Turning to the front page, our first article, Diddy Jury Will Face Intriguing Questions. Lawyers Take Crucial Steps as Selection Starts, by Aisha Bangchi, Dateline, New York. If your significant other cheated on you, could you get past it? At first blush, the answer might not seem relevant to Sean Diddy Combs' upcoming sex trafficking trial. But it's the surprising type of clue lawyers may look for in picking jurors. The hip-hop mogul faces charges that he trafficked women for freak-off sex parties and ran a criminal enterprise that included kidnapping and forced labor. If Combs is found guilty, he could spend the rest of his life in prison. On May 5, prosecutors in Combs' defense will begin the crucial step of selecting jurors. The process includes potential jurors filling out a written questionnaire and answering verbal questions from the judge or possibly even from the lawyers. The judge can eliminate potential jurors who can't attend the full trial for personal reasons or can't commit to being fair and impartial. Each side will then get a chance to eliminate a limited number of remaining potential jurors for their own reasons. The defense didn't respond to a request for comment on how it's preparing for jury selection, and the prosecution declined to comment. However, USA Today talked to jury and trial experts about what it could look like. Here's what they said about the upcoming jury selection. Can jurors compartmentalize violent Cassie Ventura video? One of the most difficult pieces of evidence for Combs may be a video depicting him dragging and kicking his ex-girlfriend, Cassie Ventura, in a hotel hallway. Judge Aaron Subramanian ruled in late April that prosecutors who say the video took place during a freak-off and is devastating proof of sex trafficking can show it to the jury. Combs' defense team has argued in court filings that the video was doctored. Robert Hirshhorn, a lawyer and jury consultant, told USA Today that the defense may deal with the video by arguing that Combs was overcharged. He might be guilty of domestic violence, but prosecutors instead charged him with sex trafficking. Hirshhorn has represented several high-profile clients, such as George Zimmerman, who was acquitted of murder and manslaughter in the death of black teenager Trayvon Martin. If the judge allows it, Hirshhorn might ask potential jurors if they are the type of people who could work through and compartmentalize their significant other cheating, or whether that would forever affect the relationship. The answer might help gauge if the person could also get past the video. Everybody that says compartmentalize, I don't care what else they say. Unless they say, I already think Diddy's guilty, I'm putting them on the jury every day, Hirshhorn said. The juror who couldn't get past the cheating? They're a dog with a bone, Hirshhorn said. They can't ever forget about it. That's the juror that will convict. Race, gender, and sexual assault experiences matter in selection. Wealthy defendants, in particular, will sometimes hold mini trials with focus groups and send out surveys about the case. It's all part of developing profiles of people you want on your jury, and perhaps especially of people you don't want. Jury selection is really jury deselection. Eric Rudick, a social psychologist and litigation strategist at Blueprint Trial Consulting, told USA Today. It's not what you're looking for. It's the people you feel like they're going to be really bad for you. Prosecutors may seek to root out people who are wary of the government. Several of the questions that prosecutors want potential jurors to be asked have to do with feelings on law enforcement and experiences with the government. Experiences with sexual assault or with being accused of assault could also be a major factor. Both sides have proposed questions to potential jurors about those experiences. Prosecutors want to try to keep on this jury any woman that has been the victim of some kind of unwanted sexual contact, Hirshhorn said. Combs' team wants potential jurors to describe the music they like as well as their opinions about the hip-hop and rap music industry. That could be an avenue for figuring out if a potential juror has a bias toward Combs, either because of his race or the industry he is in. You can't strike jurors based on ethnicity unless they reveal explicit bias, Rudich said. But questions about people's opinions about hip-hop culture, P. Diddy in general, that's probably going to reveal attitudes and predilections for favoring one side or another. Feelings on alternative sexual lifestyles will be addressed. Combs' lead attorney, Mark Agnifilo, said in an April hearing that the defense team plans to tell jurors at trial that Combs belonged to an alternative sexual lifestyle as they make their case that he didn't traffic women. Call it swingers, Agnifilo said. Swinging involves singles or people in committed relationships who engage in consensual, non-monogamous sexual behavior. The defense team's proposed questionnaire suggests they want to know if jurors are open-minded to that kind of lifestyle or would hold it against Combs. There may be evidence in this case about people engaging in relationships with multiple sexual partners. Would hearing about that type of evidence affect your ability to serve as a fair and impartial juror in this case? The questionnaire asks. To the extent that potential jurors open up about their own experiences or lifestyles within their social circles, that could be one of the best measures of whether they could be receptive to Combs' defense, according to Hirshhorn. I'd want to know if anybody's ever experimented with things like swapping or any of that kind of outside-of-the-norm sexual behavior, Hirshhorn said. If you know somebody that's a swinger, I'd take that juror. Hung jury in the making? Finding the one who just won't go along. The prosecution's goal in Combs' criminal trial isn't just to find one juror who concludes Combs is guilty. It needs all 12 jurors to agree with the conviction. That's not necessarily the strategy for Combs' defense team. While they also need a unanimous verdict to win an acquittal, a divided jury would force the prosecution to decide if it wants to try him again, and the judge might not allow for retrial after retrial after retrial. That disparity means one kind of juror the defense in particular may want is someone who just doesn't go with the crowd. The defense wants people who are iconoclastic, who will in some way feel that there is a dominant culture out there that is trying to impose things on the rest of society. Mitchell Eppner, a longtime New York litigator and a former federal prosecutor, told USA Today. Combs' defense has said it wants potential jurors to be asked about their decision-making styles in groups, including whether they go with what the majority favors. It has also proposed asking jurors about the political commentators they listen to and whether they belong to any clubs. You love an acquittal, obviously, but a hung jury is also a win for your client, Rudish said. All you need is one juror to find for you.
Complex web of issues tangles Pope selection by John Bacon. The Roman Catholic cardinals from around the world gathering on May 7 in Vatican City to elect a pope must untangle a complex web of issues as they consider candidates to lead the church's 1.4 billion followers across all seven continents. The most globally representative group of cardinals in history will be weighing such factors as geography, international political trends, the candidate's age, and the lingering fallout from years of controversy surrounding sexual abuse by the clergy. And they will determine whether the adage fat pope, thin pope holds true, or whether the next leader of the Catholic Church will continue and expand the reforms that gained traction during the 12-year reign of Pope Francis, who died April 21st. The conclave, which starts May 7, will include a maximum of four voting rounds each day until a candidate obtains a two-thirds majority. A compromise candidate could ultimately emerge, but for the first few rounds of voting, the cardinals may each be willing to repeatedly vote for their preferred candidate and see whether he gains momentum. Progressives have an edge. There are more than 250 members of the College of Cardinals, but only 133 of them are under age 80 and otherwise meet the requirements for voting. More than three-quarters of those eligible voters were appointed by Francis. Francis championed the importance of listening to everyone, from clergy to people in the pews, and he put a particular emphasis on those who have been marginalized. Still, some Catholics believe Francis's efforts to build a more welcoming and inclusive church actually fueled division among many of the faithful who have little interest in building bridges with LGBTQ plus Catholics or easing rules for divorce and remarriage within the church. Disagreements among the cardinals have already emerged in the media. Cardinal Gerhard Ludwig Müller of Germany, a conservative ousted by Francis from the top Vatican position in 2017, is among those who have discussed division in the church and called for unity. Cardinal Michael Czerny of Canada, a close advisor to Francis, has dismissed division as an issue for the conclave. Will there be strong disagreements? We've already seen competing understandings of the word unity from Cardinals Mueller and Czerny. Daniel Kosaki, author of The Great American Prophets, Pope Francis's Models of Christian Life, told USA Today, I would suspect that it is unlikely that those two cardinals would be voting for the same person in the first couple of ballots. New Catholic leader likely won't be clone of Pope Francis. Francis DiBernardo, executive director of New Ways Ministry, a national Catholic outreach group advocating for LGBTQ plus acceptance and equity, says he expects a compromise candidate will ultimately draw the white smoke from the Sistine Chapel, signaling the selection of a new pope. But he says he is not concerned that the church could backpedal from Francis's efforts. I'm expecting that while the new pope will not be a clone of Pope Francis, he will be someone who maintains a great deal of his inclusive approach, DiBernardo told USA Today. Even if the cardinals elect a pope who is the opposite of Pope Francis, I think it will be very hard to undo all the good that Pope Francis had on people in church. Will the next pope navigate immigration issues? The next pope must navigate the rise of far-right extremism and authoritarianism. Global politics come with the job. Francis was outspoken against Trump's administration's crackdown on immigration and was a fierce critic of the Ukraine-Russia war and the Israeli-Hamas war. His successor will either continue the trend of speaking out or recede into the shadows of international political issues. Within the church, Francis shifted the pastoral focus toward a more hospitable, welcoming attitude, championed those who had long felt excluded. He allowed clergy to bless same-sex couples. Francis also eased the annulment process for divorces, promoted flexibility for church participation in second marriages, and encouraged allowing those spouses to receive communion in the same cases. It would be hard to backpedal on these shifts without causing real alienation, says Susan Reynolds, interim director of Catholic Studies at Emory University in Atlanta, whose work has focused on race, culture, and migration. How geography could play a role. There has been an effort to expand the reach of the Vatican to emerging Catholic strongholds in Asia, Africa, and elsewhere. Francis, an Argentinian, was the first Latin American pope. By 2050, almost one-third of all Catholics will likely live in Africa, according to World Christian Database. Some of those emerging Catholic populations, particularly in Africa, are more conservative than Catholics in Europe and the U.S. Culture and geography could play a role in the selecting of the Pope this time around, says Reverend James Retzica, a theology professor at John Carroll University in University Heights, Ohio. Part of being a world church, means that the papacy needs to be seen as representing the cross-section of the world and not just Europe or Italy, he said. Will there be a power struggle among European cardinals versus non-Europeans? Bretzky mused. Will racial and or ethnic differences be unnamed tensions or biases for or against some of the candidates that are otherwise considered palpable? How long will the conclave take? The conclave will continue until a pope is elected. One vote is expected the first day, then two each morning, and two each afternoon, until a candidate claims the two-third majority. If the electors fail to reach an agreement after 3 days, a break of up to 1 day is allowed for prayer, free discussion among voters, and a brief spiritual exhortation. There is no set time limit for the conclave, but recent conclaves have lasted only a few days. The longest conclave in modern times, in 1903, ended when Pope Pius X was chosen after 5 days. In the 13th century, the papacy was vacant for almost 3 years before the election of Gregory X, who tightened up conclave rules. The Reverend Patrick Flanagan, Associate Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at St. John's University in New York, says Gregory X made it clear that conclaves should be focused and expeditious. According to the original prescription, if a pope had not been elected after 3 days, a cardinal was restricted to one dish at their meals, Flanagan said. After 8 days, only bread, wine, and water. Despite some conflicts over the direction the church should take, most experts don't expect the conclave to stretch beyond a few days. Reynolds noted that Francis was elected in less than 2 days. I would be surprised to see another conclave quite so brief, but I don't anticipate that it will drag on, she said. Who are the top pope contenders? Some of the names frequently mentioned as candidates to succeed Francis include Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle, 67, of the Philippines, a liberal sometimes referred to as Francis II, and Cardinal Peter Erdo, 72, of Hungary, who is considered a favorite among the more conservative cardinals. There have been 266 popes, and 217 of them have been Italian. Italy was has strong contenders again, Matteo Zuppi, 69, a close associate of Francis, and Pietro Parolin, 70, the Vatican Secretary of State, who is considered a moderate. Flanagan says he has seen some of the internet buzz, including reviews of the Elite Eight, Fabulous Four, and the latest May Madness chart, but he emphasized the adage in Pope, out cardinal, meaning anyone who goes into a conclave thinking they will become pope usually exits the conclave still a cardinal. Anyone who acts like they want to be pope shouldn't be pope. No one runs for Pope, and campaigning is a bad idea and prohibited anyway, Reynolds said. Anything that feels too much like campaigning is seen as gauche. The old wisdom goes, anyone who acts like they want to be Pope shouldn't be Pope, she said. Given the diverse makeup of the voters, it's hard to predict where the wind will blow. If the voting drags out, the age of the next pope could become an issue to those who feel compelled to compromise for the sake of a consensus. How long do we want this guy in power? This one becomes more important the longer it takes to get consensus, says Melissa Wild, a sociologist of religion and inequality and chairperson of the Department of Sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. Kosaki, the author who serves as vice president for mission and ministry at the University of Scranton, said the adage that after a fat pope, a thin pope is elected to alter the direction of the church is not always the case. He says it is unclear how it will play out this time around, but there could be a potential impasse. Kosaki says those who could serve as kingmakers include older cardinals such as Giovanni Battista Re, 91 of Italy, Stanislaus Zwists, 86 of Poland, Francis Arzini, 92 of Nigeria, Angelo Scolo, 83, Italy, Oswaldo Gracias, 80 of India, and Christoph Schönborn, 80 of Austria. There has never been a pope from the United States, a trend that is likely to continue, Bretsky said. A pope is a diplomat who must be accepted globally, he said. These considerations will continue, in my opinion, to prevent any American from being elected the next pope, even if otherwise he might be well qualified. America's image in the world simply is too powerful and, to be blunt, ugly. The Reverend Brian E. Concole, Vice President and Dean of Syracuse University's Hendricks Chapel, is not Catholic. But Concole says the election of the new pope is not only a massive movement for Catholics, it also impacts people of all faiths from all areas of our world. I suspect a healthy tension will exist between tradition and innovation, yet ultimately it will be about the person they believe is being called upon by God to serve, Concole said. The world is indeed watching and waiting, because whoever emerges will immediately become one of the most influential leaders of our generation. Cardinal Timothy Dolan, Archbishop of New York, is one of the few cardinals who participated in the election of Francis 12 years ago. Speaking on Fox News Channel's The Story with Martha McCollum, he said the cardinals don't view each other as conservative or progressive, but as believers, as disciples, as brothers. Dolan says the cardinals do feel pressure when making the decision, but he cited 2013 when the conclave was opened with a prayer from a Franciscan preacher. He said, "Eminences, you are all scared because you have a tough job to elect the next pope. Let me put your mind at ease. It's easy. The Holy Spirit has already chosen the next pope. Your job is to find out who that is." We all chuckled and said, "Hey, that's kind of nice to hear," Dolan said.
Activists decry unraveling of civil rights. By Deborah Barfield Berry, Dateline, Washington. In the first 100 days of President Donald Trump's second term, his administration has eliminated diversity initiatives across federal agencies, pushed to roll back provisions of the Civil Rights Act, and fired some staffers working on civil rights issues. The administration has done more to undo decades of civil rights work than any other president in recent memory, some activists and rights experts say. The pace of unraveling civil rights protections has been unlike anything I've seen in my lifetime, said Fatima Goss Graves, president of the National Women's Law Center. It is a reminder that we have to fight again and again for those critical protections. Trump and some conservative scholars say it was well past time to redirect the priorities of the Federal Justice Department and push back against what they call the woke agenda. They're not unraveling decades of civil rights work, said Hans von Spakovsky, a senior legal fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation. What they're doing is putting a priority on enforcement matters that have been totally neglected by the prior administration. There are more than 200 lawsuits challenging Trump's executive orders and other changes. Groups have also launched boycotts of businesses that retreated from diversity initiatives. But even if those efforts succeed, Trump's actions have already caused tremendous damage, activists say. With the stroke of a pen, the administration has set in motion the dismantling of laws intended to protect people from discrimination in schools, the workplace, and at the polls. If not challenged, activists say, they could set the civil rights movement back decades. It's been a full frontal assault, and it's left people quaking. It's left people shaking. It's left people deeply angry, deeply upset, deeply agitated to see their rights yanked away from them, said Barbara Arnwine, president and founder of Transformative Justice, a civil rights organization. People feel like they're being more and more othered in their own country. Trump has signed several executive orders related to civil rights, including one early in his administration that eliminated diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives across the federal government. Another required federal agencies to recognize only two sexes, male and female. More recently, Trump signed an order that would repeal or amend provisions of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, saying his change guarantees equality of opportunity, not equal outcomes. In addition, the administration has closed civil rights offices in some federal agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security, and fired civil rights and DEI workers. It has also halted some civil rights cases at the Education Department. Some conservatives say it's about time, especially at the DOJ. The agency should file discrimination lawsuits no matter the group, including ones protecting white people, Von Spakovsky said. But it hasn't adequately pursued those cases, he said. If you look at all the laws that the Civil Rights Division enforces, whether it's the Voting Rights Act or the Civil Rights Act, the laws are race-neutral, said Von Spakovsky, who worked at the agency for 4 years. When they were first passed, the cases, almost all of them, involved discrimination against black Americans, against Hispanics, against Asians. But the laws protect everyone. He also applauded the president's executive order titled Restoring Equality of Opportunity and Meritocracy, which aimed to address what Trump called the unlawfulness of disparate impact liability in the Civil Rights Act. The law requires a policy or action to be changed if it has a disparate impact, leading to discrimination of a particular group, even if that was not its intent. The administration argues that this disparate impact liability violates the Constitution, federal civil rights laws, and basic American ideals, because it requires businesses to consider race to avoid crippling legal liability. Using disparate impact is not a valid way of proving discrimination, Von Spakovsky said. What I believe they're doing is that they're going back to the original intent and the original purpose of those laws and enforcing them the way Congress intended them to be enforced, he said. Trump's agenda on civil rights follows the playbook of Project 2025, a conservative plan to overhaul the federal government, including eliminating agencies like the Education Department, civil rights activists say. As a candidate, Trump repeatedly distanced himself from the Project 2025 agenda. Mark Morial, president of the National Urban League, a civil rights organization, called Trump's executive orders Project 2025 on steroids. It's gut-wrenching, disheartening, very, very tragic for the nation, he said. It's an attack on the future. The Reverend Al Sharpton, president of the National Action Network, described Trump's first 100 days as Project 2025 in motion. Let's not treat these like reforms when they are clear attacks on civil rights many marched and bled and in some cases died for, Sharpton said in a statement. Representative James Clyburn, Democrat, South Carolina, a former history teacher, said it's not the first time a president or Congress has tried to roll back civil rights protections. He noted the backlash after Reconstruction, a period after the Civil War where newly freed enslaved people became politically involved, only to later face nearly a century of racial violence. Things in this country have never moved on a linear plane, Clyburn said. Goss Graves said Trump's agenda, including his attack on the Civil Rights Act, is clear. They're not just going for diversity and inclusion programs. They're not going for some limited ideas, she said. They will not be satisfied until that compact from the Civil Rights Act, that 60-year-old compact, is destroyed. We will fight for it with our every breath. For veterans of the civil rights movement, watching what they see as a dismantling of the civil rights law they fought for has been disappointing and infuriating. It has spurred them to ramp up their efforts to train the next generation of organizers. My focus is trying to figure out how do we organize the black community and other communities, said Cortland Cox, a veteran of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Cox said no one should be surprised about Trump's actions because he has long made his intentions known. I really don't care what he thinks, he said. Only thing I care about is that he's not in power. Judy Richardson, also a SNCC veteran, said Trump's moves go way beyond just rolling back civil rights gains. It's an attack on all Americans, she said. It's important that we, who organized in the 1960s civil rights movement, don't view this as just another rodeo or we've been through this before, Richardson said. What Trump and his followers are forging really is a full-scale assault against all our democratic institutions and the rule of law as we've known it in recent times. If we don't understand that, what we're dealing with now is far more dangerous than anything we fought against during the civil rights movement. We won't be able to adequately mount a counteroffensive, she said.
FEMA full-time staff dwindles as hurricane season nears, by Dinah Foley's-Pulver. Federal Emergency Management Agency employees are trained to respond to disasters, but have struggled this spring with the situation unfolding at their agency. While they have been deployed to wildfires in Los Angeles, flooding along the Kentucky River, and throughout the southeast in response to Hurricane Helene, FEMA workers have watched a roiling turmoil of staff cuts, slashed budgets, and threats to dismantle their agency. They're fielding difficult questions from friends, co-workers, and disaster victims about what the future holds. It's caused a lot of confusion, said Michael Cohn, a FEMA veteran of more than 15 years, who left his position as chief of staff on Inauguration Day. At least 2,000 of the agency's roughly 6,100 full-time employees have either left or plan to leave under the waves of terminations and voluntary retirements ordered by Elon Musk's Department of Governmental Efficiency, told USA Today. That doesn't include a reduction in force expected to take place in the federal government in the coming weeks. President Donald Trump also has launched an agency review and cut funds for some FEMA grant programs, outraging officials in states where those funds already had been committed. The controversy taps into a long-running debate over the role of states and the federal government in disaster response. It's hard to find a public official who doesn't think the way the nation responds to disasters could be improved. But the 30% cut in its full-time staff raises concerns about whether FEMA will be able to respond to major disasters during the approaching summer storm season that could bring hurricanes, tornadoes, and wildfires. Jay Inslee, whose term as the Democratic governor of Washington State ended in January, is among those gravely concerned about FEMA's ability to respond. Gutting FEMA is just going to make more and more families have to be living under blue tarps for years and not to have the financial assistance they deserve when they pay their taxes, Inslee said. I am outraged on their behalf. Major disasters require federal resources, and state and local governments cannot cope on their own, said Shonda Uvardi, senior climate resilience policy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists. With the summer danger season of extreme weather, including climate-fueled disasters, getting underway soon, these attacks on FEMA could not come at a worse time, Uvardi said. Congress must push back assertively on these egregious plans in a bipartisan way. Disasters do not discriminate based on politics. When enormous natural disasters befall communities, especially small ones, they just don't have the local resources, Inslee said. It's basically everybody pitching in together from the county to the Red Cross to the state to the federal government. FEMA's remaining full-time employees, even those who work at headquarters and don't typically deploy, have been warned to be ready to deploy to disasters this summer. The agency has been short-staffed for years, federal documents show. The staff flexes up and down as the need arises, with roughly 12,000 employees who respond as reservists or local temporary hires. Among the cuts this year to the permanent employees were 200 probationary staff dismissed because they had been either recently hired or recently promoted. Cohn said another 800 took the fork in the road plan that placed employees on administrative leave with pay until the end of the summer when they'd lose their jobs. A lot of people with the agency were just exhausted, he said. Last year was a very challenging year for FEMA employees with all the disasters that took place, plus all the Hurricane Helene misinformation. In the aftermath of Helene, some FEMA officials found their personal information had been made public on the web, and some were threatened. The inauguration opened a new chapter. Trump had been critical of FEMA during the campaign, and his first official trip was to visit the Helene disaster zone in western North Carolina, where he said the administration was very disappointed in FEMA. After information was leaked from one early meeting with the new FEMA officials, at least a dozen staff members were asked to submit to a lie detector test, Cohn said. Employees are afraid to talk even to former colleagues because they're afraid they might be subjected to a lie detector. If the head of the agency isn't even respected by the secretary's office, if he's being subjected to a lie detector test, you know, why would I stay here? Even some of the younger staff are thinking, I don't need this anxiety, he said.
Turning to the business section, the ultimate icebreaker, pin trading, is popular at Disney parks, by Eve Chen. I told my friend Tara I was kind of into pins on our most recent Disney trip. My framed collection at home would disagree with my measured enthusiasm. As we stopped at nearly every pin trading board we encountered in Magic Kingdom and Disney's Hollywood Studios, Tara soon learned the same. I wasn't lying. I genuinely don't think of myself on the same level as serious collectors, but I've always liked collecting pretty things. Stamps, postcards, ornaments, mugs. For me, it's just fun. Turns out that's all you need to be into pin trading. Here's what you should know about the popular pastime in Disney parks. Is pin trading still a thing? Yes, Disney pin trading is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, and it's as popular as ever. Now, Disney carried pins long before trading came into the picture, and pin trading existed outside the parks well before that, namely at the Olympics, Stephen Miller explained. But in 1999, he helped introduce the activity to Disney World as a way for guests and cast members to connect during the Walt Disney World Millennium Celebration, and it has since expanded across Disney experiences. What better way to do than that than trading pins, because you're literally exchanging hand-to-hand, said Miller, who has changed roles and is now a senior manager with Disney Corporate Social Responsibility. We quickly discovered that people really liked pin trading. It was immensely popular, not just popular with our guests, but our cast members, too. It just starts this great conversation with the guests that's unique to them, which is our ultimate goal, said Bridget Gall, General Manager of Merchandise at Disney's Animal Kingdom. I started collecting pins during Disney World's 50th anniversary, which kicked off in 2021. I liked how the pins were little works of art, and I wanted to commemorate something personal to me, one of my first big events as a travel reporter. Bit by bit, my collection has grown with other milestones and mementos. The one thing I know I tell my team consistently is that this is somebody's memory, said Jessica Willis, Senior Manager of Product Design for Disney Pins. Are pins worth collecting? Some pins can be worth thousands of dollars, but value is in the eye of the beholder. I have pins from 99, 2000, 2001 that are specific to the memories I had here with my family, said Willis, who pin traded as a guest during the Millennium Celebration. Her pins weren't particularly expensive or exclusive, but for her, they're memories, and so I will never trade them, I will never give them away. Other pins are literally priceless because you can't buy them. You can get them only by trading with cast members. Once known as hidden Mickey pins for having tiny Mickey heads on their pin face, they've now evolved into hidden Disney pins with different icons depending on the pin's intellectual property, like Pixar or Marvel. They kind of come out in these waves or these releases, and it gives a reason for our guests, even those who may be local or who may come back time and time again, something new to go after, Willis said. For a limited time, guests can only get those pins through that cast interaction, and I think that makes it even more special. Many guests try to collect all the pins in a specific set or series. How many types of Disney pins are there? Four types of Disney pins are available to the public. The most widely available pins are called Open Edition. Those are the pins that you'll see just about everywhere. There's no finite number or time that those pins are available, Willis said. They'll probably have the broadest range of characters, so you'll see the most variety within those Open Editions. Next are Limited Release pins. The limited release are pins that may be a little bit more what we call embellished, or the make of them might be a little bit higher than that Open Edition pin, but they're out for a limited time, she said. There are also limited release pins tied to specific park events like festivals or after-hours events. The rarest pins are limited edition. Limited edition pins actually have a quantity stamp to the back of it. Maybe there's a limited edition of 4,000 of those pins, and that's all we'll create, Willis said. Now I'm in the collector space, and I see that as a collectible value, and I want to hang on to that. The fourth type of pins are those hidden Disney pins that come from trading with cast members. How to start pin trading. Disney sells starter sets and booster sets with multiple pins to get guests started. Mickey head-shaped trading boards are scattered across Disney World and Disneyland. There's usually one at the front desk of resort hotel lobbies, at guest services kiosks, sometimes in shops. On my last Disney World visit, I was surprised to find a pin board poolside at Coronado Springs Resort. Many cast members also will wear lanyards or pouches with pins for trading. You can have one or two pins on your lanyard flipping around. Sometimes they call it a blind trade, Gall said. Cast members may have guests answer trivia for the chance to trade those pins. At Animal Kingdom, she said, the questions may be tied to the animals. Now, whether they answered the trivia right or wrong, we still trade, she said. Guests can trade up to two pins per cast member on a specific trading board per day. I've heard so many parents say it opened the door for their child to walk up to a cast member and learn a conversation and say please and thank you and have this ability for them to collect what they like and what was important to them and be able to showcase their personality, Miller said. Adds Willis, it's a way, especially in a digital age, that you're having those interactions. You're having to talk to someone face-to-face, eye-to-eye, and have that open dialogue. What's your favorite character? What's your favorite memory? And then they ask the same of us. Can Disney cast members say no to pin trading? Yes. According to guidelines posted on Disney World and Disneyland's websites, cast members may determine whether a pin is tradable at their discretion. As long as it's an official Disney pin, they will gladly trade. Fellow guests may be more particular and decline to trade if the pins you're offering in exchange don't interest them. What are the rules for Disney pins? The pin should be an official Disney pin in good condition. Metal pin bearing a copyright Disney mark, so on the back, the copyright, Miller specified. That means it's a Disney pin. And then the trading guidelines are still two pins per cast member, per guest, per day. Can you buy Disney pins online? Yes, the Disney Store sells pins online and adds new ones regularly. Some guests also buy pins from third-party resellers through online sources like eBay, Amazon, and Facebook Marketplace. But watch out. If the pins are suspiciously cheap or off-color, they may not be authentic. For perspective, Disney pins typically start at $9.99 retail. How do you tell if a Disney pin is a scrapper? Collectors often refer to knockoff pins as scrappers. Pin HQ by Go Pin Pro, a Winter Garden, Florida-based business that sells officially licensed pins and trading gear, shared several telltale signs via Instagram. Scrappers may be made with soft enamel with dips and paint instead of hard enamel, which would be polished flat. Mickey head patterns pressed into the backs of official Disney pins go all the way to the edges, while knockoffs may have a border. Scrappers may also appear duller, rougher, or generally lower quality. I don't worry too much about authenticity. I purchase the pins I want directly from Disney, but I also buy extra pins when they go on sale online. If I see something I like on a pin board or a cast lanyard, I'll trade with the latter. That way, if I do end up with a scrapper, at least it's pretty.
Average Americans Struggle with Savings by Rachel Barber. When discussing the effects of his tariffs, President Donald Trump said maybe children will get $2 instead of $30, and maybe they'll cost a couple of bucks more in 2025. But could the average American afford $30? It might be difficult. The average American makes roughly $62,000 a year. More than half of Americans say they're barely making ends meet, and 2 out of 5 don't have $1,000 to spare if their car breaks down or another emergency crops up. In contrast, Trump, who Forbes estimates has a net worth hovering around $5 billion, has surrounded himself with other billionaires, appointing several of them to the wealthiest presidential cabinet in U.S. history. His pick to lead the Department of Government Efficiency, Elon Musk, is the richest person in the world. This year alone, Musk lost nearly $100 billion of his net worth, leaving him with $333 billion, Bloomberg estimates. That's more money than the average American could get even if they win the Powerball jackpot, which has never exceeded $2.04 billion. The odds for grabbing such a windfall are 1 in 292.2 million. So what's the financial reality for the average person? One crisis away from homelessness. While discretionary spending is somewhat determined by priorities, income is the key factor when calculating what and where to spend. A recent NerdWallet survey found that 57% of Americans said they were living paycheck to paycheck. As wealth inequality continues to rise, more than half of the nation is, in effect, one crisis away from homelessness, according to the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. What is the median U.S. salary? American workers made a median salary of $1,192 per week in the first quarter of 2025, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics report, which would add up to $61,984 per year. But how much do you make often depends on various factors, including gender. In the year's first quarter, women brought in a median wage of $1,092 per week, earning less than men who brought in $1,303. Median wages also can vary by race. Asian men and women earned the most, making $1,822 and $1,455 per week, respectively. They were followed by white men and women, who earned $1,342 and $1,103 per week, respectively. Median weekly wages for black men and Hispanic men were the next highest, making $1,017 and $991 per week, respectively. They were followed by black women and Hispanic women, who earned $984 and $879 per week, respectively. What is the minimum wage? The federal minimum wage is $7.25 per hour and has been since 2009. Most U.S. states, districts, and territories have established higher minimum wages above the federal rate for their residents. But in 22 states and 2 territories, the federal minimum wage applies. Overall, 1 million Americans work for wages at or below the federal minimum in 2022, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Among them, 141,000 workers made exactly $7.25 per hour, or about 882,000 earned less. To get by in most states, the MIT Living Wage Calculator estimates the average single person needs to make about $45,000 a year, or $21.63 an hour, assuming a 40-hour work week. You'll need more in states with higher costs of living, like California and New York. More than half of Americans struggle to pay for emergencies. Although 60% of Americans said they needed to cover an unexpected expense last year, 2 in 5 don't have an emergency savings fund and couldn't afford a $1,000 unexpected expense, according to the U.S. News survey. Demographics also matter in terms of savings. At 49%, almost half the women said they didn't have an emergency fund, compared to 36% of men, according to the survey. For those without savings, the most popular way to cover an emergency expense is to use a credit card, according to a Bankrate report. That strategy comes with high interest rates that can leave Americans in an even worse financial situation. Experts advise building an emergency fund as soon as you can.
Turning to sports, interim no more. Mitch Johnson, not a new face for Spurs by Lorenzo Reyes. New San Antonio Spurs head coach Mitch Johnson isn't exactly new, at least not with the franchise. Johnson, who was promoted after coach Greg Popovich transitioned fully to his role in the Spurs front office, has been with the organization in various capacities since 2016. Johnson's most prominent role came this past season when he took over as interim coach for 77 games after Popovich suffered a mild stroke November 2nd before a 113-103 victory over the Minnesota Timberwolves. Johnson led San Antonio to a 32-45 record this season in the games he coached. Things to know about Mitch Johnson. Coaching and playing history. Johnson, 38, has served under Popovich since 2019 when he joined the Spurs staff as an assistant. He was promoted in 2020 to the front of Popovich's bench and had been considered one of the NBA's top young assistant coaches before taking over the Spurs on an interim basis this season. The 24-25 regular season marked the third time Johnson stepped in as San Antonio's interim coach. The first came in May 2021 when Popovich attended the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame induction of former great Spurs great Tim Duncan. Johnson and San Antonio lost that game 140-103 to the Suns. The second time was in March 2023 when Popovich missed one game with a non-COVID-19 illness. Johnson earned his first NBA coaching victory then, 110-99 over the Pacers. Popovich returned the following game. Previously, Johnson had coached with the organization's G League affiliate, the Austin Spurs, from 2016 through 2019. He was an assistant under coaches Ken McDonald and Blake Ahern. Johnson played four seasons of Division I basketball at Stanford from 2005 through 2009, averaging 5.3 points, 4.1 assists, and 3.0 rebounds per game. Johnson helped lead the Cardinal to a pair of NCAA tournament appearances, including a run to the Sweet 16 in 2008. After his college playing career, Johnson had a brief stint in the G League with the Tulsa 66ers. Johnson is the son of former two-time NBA All-Star John Johnson. What will Johnson need to do as head coach? Essentially, Johnson will try to maintain the system and culture Popovich has built over his nearly three decades as the Spurs coach. That Johnson was promoted so quickly indicates that he was seen all along as a successor to Popovich and a steward of relative stability. Johnson will need to continue to develop star phenom Victor Wembanyama as the centerpiece of the team. The midseason trade for point guard De'Aaron Fox gave San Antonio another dynamic playmaker, and while both sustained season-ending injuries this season, crafting an explosive offense around the pair and Rookie of the Year guard Stephon Castle could make San Antonio a candidate to break out next season to end a six-year playoff drought. What the Spurs have said about Johnson. Throughout his time with the organization, players and staffers alike have endorsed Johnson with rave reviews. Aside from Popovich and Johnson's other bosses, however, the most important opinion belongs to Wembanyama, who will be the cornerstone of the Spurs for years to come. After the final game of the season, Wembanyama, perhaps sensing that Johnson would eventually be promoted, said, according to ESPN, "I trust the organization. I trust Pop to do all he can to come back and get his energy back. And I also trust Mitch to grow into that role. I think we are in good hands supporting each other all throughout the organization. I'm ready for anything, and I know the organization will make the good decisions."
Trump considers executive order by Joey Garrison and Steve Berkowitz. Dateline Washington. President Donald Trump is giving serious consideration to signing an executive order that would address payments to college athletes. A person familiar with the matter confirmed to USA Today on May 2nd. The person requested anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly about the matter. Trump's review of the matter comes in the wake of a conversation he had with former University of Alabama football coach Nick Saban on May 1st, when Trump was in Tuscaloosa to speak at the university's commencement ceremonies. The order could potentially add oversight to name, image, and likenesses, or NIL, that has exploded across college athletics with few regulations, although how the order would address NIL was not immediately clear. The Wall Street Journal first reported Trump's consideration of the action, which would add to the more than 140 executive orders he signed in his first 102 days, spanning a range of issues. Saban has been critical of the current state of college sports, including at a roundtable event in Washington that was hosted by Senator Ted Cruz, Republican Texas, in March 2024 as part of Cruz's ongoing effort to craft college sports legislation that can pass Congress. Saban said at the time athletes' personal development was being hindered by a combination of virtually unregulated opportunities to make money from NIL and their ability to transfer multiple times in their college careers. He also called for rules that create some kind of competitive balance, which right now we don't have in college athletics. It's whoever wants to pay the most money, raise the most money, buy the most players is going to have the best opportunity to win. I don't think that's the spirit of college athletes, said Saban. U.S. Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican, Alabama, said he had a great conversation with Trump on Air Force One about the importance of establishing national standards for NIL during the president's trip to his state. College football is the heart and soul of America, but it's in danger if we don't level the playing field, said Tuberville, a former football coach at Auburn University and other schools. Trump's potential entry into this area comes as lawyers for the plaintiffs, NCAA and Power Five conferences, have been trying to revise one aspect of the proposed settlement of three athletic compensation antitrust cases that the U.S. District Judge Claudia Wilkin has said she is otherwise prepared to give final approval. Under the arrangement, $2.8 billion in damages would be paid to current and former athletes and their lawyers over 10 years, and Division I schools would be able to start paying athletes directly for use of their NIL, subject to a per-school cap that would increase over time and be based on a percentage of certain athletic revenue. Athletes would continue to be allowed to have NIL deals with non-school entities, but any deals worth $600 or more would be subject to greater scrutiny than they are now. While the proposed settlement could solve some problems for the NCAA and its conferences and schools, they have continued to lobby Congress for legislation that would, among other things, enshrine in federal law athletes' NIL rights, preempt dozens of state laws that have been passed in connection with the athletes' NIL rights, and give the NCAA a measure of legal protection against antitrust actions. This is where Trump could step in. Trump instructed White House aides to begin studying what an order would look like, according to the Wall Street Journal. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat, Connecticut, said in a statement May 2nd to USA Today of Trump's potential involvement, college sports reform can only happen through congressional legislation based on bipartisan negotiations that put college athletes first. The president is welcome to support Senate negotiations, but he has no power to attempt to rule by decree, especially to give handouts to the NCAA over the blood, sweat, and tears of players. One of the lead lawyers for the plaintiffs in the antitrust case, Steve Behrman, in a statement to USA Today, blasted the prospect of Trump's involvement in any way that would limit athletes. The president says he's the greatest business person ever, Berman wrote. Why would he do anything to limit the business deals students are negotiating for their NIL? He has been a benefit he has been a benefit of the free market. Why not these young people? As for Saban, what a hypocrite. He has been an opponent of NIL from the start, while he made tens of millions off the backs of these athletes. Even Justice Kavanaugh, one of Trump's appointed judges, stated that his Alston decision that was this was stated in his Alston decision that this was wrong. Trump should talk to Coach Jim Harbaugh, who is a fan of the burgeoning NIL market and not a fan of the system of coach exploitation that Saban benefited from. Bourbon was referencing Justice Brett Kavanaugh's concurring opinion to the Supreme Court's unanimous ruling in the Alston versus NCAA antitrust case, in which the High Court ended the association's limits on education-related benefits athletes can receive for playing college sports. Kavanaugh heavily criticized the NCAA's limits on athletes' compensation, writing, among other things, the NCAA's business model would be flatly illegal in almost any other industry in America. Harbaugh, now with the NFL's Los Angeles Chargers, repeatedly advocated for greater compensation for college athletes during his 9 seasons as the University of Michigan's football coach.
This is Andy Shupak's In Appreciation column, headlined Adventurous Jim Dent, From Caddy to Player. Long-hitting Jim Dent was known as one of the best black golfers of his era after going from the caddy yard at Augusta National Golf Club to winning a dozen times on the PGA Tour Champions. He died on May 2nd, according to his family, at 85. Born May 9, 1939, in Augusta, Georgia, Dent grew up caddying at Augusta National, home of the Masters, and nearby Augusta Country Club. At the 1956 Masters, he caddied for Bob Rosberg, who went on to win the 1959 PGA Championship and became best known as a TV commentator after his playing days. "We shot 41 in the back nine, or we might have won," Dent recalled. As a child, Dent's father, Tom, drove a pulpwood truck and owned wooded farmland not far from Augusta Country Club. The fourth of 6 children, Dent's job on the farm was to make the fire in the morning. "I was big enough to do that," Dent told the United States Golf Association. "I was still real young when my parents died, but there was my aunt. Her name was Mary Benton, a great lady in my life." Dent's mother, Carrie, died when he was 6. His father died when Jim was 12. Benton, a housekeeper at one of Augusta's big houses, raised Jim and 3 of his siblings with a firm hand. "The first time I caddied, I got a whoopin'," Dent told USA Today in 1990. "My aunt had told me not to. She said if I hung around with caddies, I'd learn how to gamble and drink. You know, a lot of those guys had those brown paper bags in their back pockets. But you know how it is. If your mother tells you not to cross the street, not to go to a certain place, if you're an adventurous kid, sooner or later you'll go there." For Dent, every loop was an opportunity to closely study elite players and apply their techniques to his own swing. By the time he was 15, Dent started to excel at the sport. He and his buddies would sneak on the back nine of Augusta Country Club late in the afternoon and play until dark. Later, he would be allowed to play there on Friday morning in exchange for cutting crabgrass. Dent stood 6'3" and 225 pounds and was a talented tight end. He attended Payne College, a small Methodist school in Augusta, on a football scholarship, although he didn't stay long. A year later, his urge to play golf led him to Atlantic City, where he made ends meet caddying at clubs and as a waiter. "I played every day until 3 or 3:30 because I didn't have to be to work until 4:30, Dent said. "I was young then. I never got tired." He did get tired of that life, however. "I felt like I was in jail, working inside and looking out the window," he says. "I wanted to work outside. I was lucky. I met a guy, Mo Stevens, who offered me a job in Los Angeles. Every morning we'd go to Compton College's football field and hit balls until school started." Dent cut his teeth playing in events hosted by the United Golfers Association, a tour that attracted the top black players from across the country before the PGA Tour integrated. He turned pro in 1966. Dent won 3 times on mini tours, including the $100,000 Queen Mary event. He failed qualifying school four times before making it in 1970 at age 31. Only once, $55,095 in 1982, did he win more than $50,000 or finish among the top 60 money winners. His journey in the game was a testament to what's possible when passion meets persistence.
Belichick Doesn't Need Public Savings by Nancy Armore. There's something uncomfortable going on with Jordan Hudson, Bill Belichick's girlfriend. Not what you might be thinking, however. Hudson is the latest in a long line of significant others, parents, siblings, friends, and hangers-on who have been outsized roles and influence in the careers of sports figures. Yet the interest in her and her position now borders on the obsessive and, in too many cases, reeks of misogyny. The 24-year-old has been cast as a gold digger and a temptress. One outlet described her as Belichick's life young girlfriend. Some have even suggested an intervention is needed as if Belichick is a 98-year-old getting scammed out of his life savings rather than a fully functioning adult capable of making his own decisions, no matter how questionable the outside world finds them. There is room to ask if Hudson is qualified to serve as Belichick's point person and publicist, given she's allowed him to show up for a national television interview in a ratty sweatshirt from a school that isn't one of the one employing him. I'd say no. It's fair game to question whether North Carolina, which is paying the six-time Super Bowl champion coach $10 million a year, knew it was getting a package deal or understood the extent to which Hudson could be involved. But all of that can be done without the salacious innuendo and sneering condescension that's marked a lot of the discourse with Hudson. From what I've heard, Jordan is playing the Bears role, former Patriot wide receiver Julian Edelman said on his Dudes on Dudes podcast, referring to Serge Narjan, Belichick's chief of staff when he was with New England, handling all of the football ops, handling a lot of his social, a lot of his PR. When you look at this situation and you say, oh, this is his girlfriend jumping in, I think that's unfair. I think she's actually working with Coach Belichick in the professional world. Again, Hudson is not above criticism. From the outside, her heavy-handedness appears to be the result of someone getting a job that, at least right now, is too big and under too much scrutiny for her skills and experience. That's hardly a first, however, in sports, or any other industry. It's the tone of the criticism, specifically the not-so-thinly-veiled sexist tropes of being used to convey it, that's getting increasingly problematic. Imagine a 24-year-old man in Hudson's role acting exactly as she is. There might be grumblings about his demeanor or complaints about his arrogance, but no one would ever suggest he was taking advantage of Belichick's use of his physical appearance to take him down a peg or troll through his high school yearbook to find people to say nasty things about him, anonymously, of course. But because Hudson and Belichick are dating, and because she's young and attractive, she must be a femme fatale who's got Belichick under her spell. That there can be one reason, and one reason only, that she is doing what she's doing in the position she's in, and it's not because she can craft a great marketing plan. It's tiresome, it's lazy, it's also misdirected.
Turning to life. This is Brian Truitt's column, headline, Rust, Find Some Beauty Amid Tragedy. Watching Rust, it's easy to be rattled by the gunshots. Being a Western drama, naturally, there's plenty of gunfights, showdowns, and old-school cowboy justice. But this is also a movie haunted by one shot in particular, the bullet that killed Ukrainian cinematographer Halina Hutchins 3.5 years ago, when a prop gun held by Alec Baldwin discharged. That shot is the hardest one to forget. After years of lawsuits, criminal charges, and controversies involving Baldwin, filmmakers, crew members, and Hutchins' family, writer-director Joel Souza's movie, 2.5 out of 4 stars, rated R, in theaters and on demand, is finally finished and being released for interested moviegoers. Story-wise, it's a solid, if overlong, tale of family and redemption. Fans of Yellowstone or Horizon will find stuff to love. Where Rust stands out is in its look, a gorgeously shot production with an emphasis on contrasts and dark colors that is a testament to the talents of Hutchins and fellow cinematographer Bianca Klein. In 1880s Wyoming, orphaned 13-year-old Lucas Hollister, played by Patrick Scott McDermott, takes care of his little brother, played by Easton Malcolm, selling off valuable animals just to put food on the table. Lucas accidentally kills a man with whom he's had a public beef and is sentenced to hang. As gallows are being built outside Lucas' jail cell, his estranged grandfather, Harlan Rust, played by Baldwin, an infamous outlaw, shows up to break him out of jail and take him to safety in Mexico, murdering a couple of lawmen in the process. His grandpa's existence is a surprise in itself to Lucas. He believed the old man was dead. And the odd pairing takes a bit to bond as Harlan is hard on the youngster. There's alive and there's ain't. Try to focus on the former, he says, trying to get the youngster in a survival mindset. Meanwhile, a bounty is put on the heads of Lucas and Harlan, which sends a wild-eyed and sadistic guy named Preacher, played by Travis Fimmel, hunting for them. U.S. Marshal Wood Helm, played by Josh Hopkins, is tasked with tracking Harlan down as well, though he struggles with leaving behind his ailing son. Between the film's strong opening and the bloody climax, Rust moseys along with subplots, side characters, and various threats to Lucas and Harlan's well-being. Baldwin is positively gruff as the world-weary Harlan, and he and McDermott fall into an interesting chemistry as the outlaw's backstory and familial connection are slowly revealed. McDermott is aces as a kid who from the start is thrown into disarray, and Hopkins is pretty terrific as the good-hearted but troubled marshal. It might surprise some that Rust was ever finished after the tragedy, yet it's clear that a good amount had to be redone. Because of scheduling conflicts, McDermott and Hopkins replaced original actors Brady Noon and Jensen Ackles in major roles, and Klein was tapped to finish the job as director of photography by Sousa, who himself was wounded by the same bullet that struck Hutchins. The film is dedicated to Hutchins and includes a saying of hers at the end, "What can we do to make this better?" For someone not involved in the production, it's a fool's errand to try to pick out what's Hutchins' work and what's Klein's. Instead, let's celebrate that the overall cinematic life that Rust conjures is exceptional. There are widescreen vistas aplenty and fantastic use of shadows throughout the movie. There's a stunning bit early on with Lucas at the graves of his parents seen from afar, and Baldwin's character is a dark, unseen figure in scenes until he introduces himself to both Lucas and the audience. Several moments set at dusk or against a cloudy sky deftly capture the movie's melancholic mood. There are uncanny echoes of real life in Rust. That an errant bullet and an accidental shooting death spur the main plot of the movie is remarkable, and the tale features several characters having to deal with the consequences of their violence. Sousa took out the scene that was the setting for Hutchins' death. Like The Crow or Twilight Zone the movie, Rust is a film forever tied to one fatal day. It's not fair or perfect, but finding beauty amid tragedy is something. And that was Brian Truitt's column.
Netflix show hits close to home for Faye by Patrick Ryan, Dateline New York. When you think of quintessential preteen movies, you likely don't imagine a cozy marriage dramedy starring Alan Alda and Carol Burnett. But growing up, The Four Seasons was a formative touchstone for young Tina Fey, who worshipped at the altar of MASH and the Carol Burnett Show. I was like, they're married. It was basically my version of Twilight fan fiction, says Faye, 54, who has now re-imaged the 1981 film as a Netflix series now streaming. Also, at that time, there was something about it that defined for me, oh, that's what grown-up life should and will be like, caring, intelligent people who wear sweaters and walk around in the fall. That's goals, adds actress Erica Henningsen, 32, reuniting with Faye after Broadway's Mean Girls and Peacock's Girls 5 Eva. And we did that. We really wore sweaters and walked around. Tina Fey gets to flex a new muscle with a dramatic Four Seasons. Co-created with Lang Fisher, Never Ever I Ever, and Tracy Wigfield, Great News, the Four Seasons follows three sets of couples, Kate, Faye, Jack, Wilfort, Nick, Steve Carroll, and Anne, Carrie Kennedy Silver, and Danny, Coleman Domingo, and Claude, Marco Calvani, as they navigate children, health, divorce, and marital frustrations. Like the movie, the 8-episode series is set over 1 year and 4 seasonal vacations. The show was an exercise in restraint for the razor-sharp Faye, who spent 9 seasons as a writer and cast member on NBC's Saturday Night Live and went on to make offbeat, joke-dense comedies 30 Rock and Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. It was like, okay, so we're not going to end this on a joke? These people are just going to have their feelings and the scene's going to end? Faye quips, but anecdotally, people seem to appreciate it. Sometimes when there's 10,000 jokes, it can inhibit you from actually caring about the story. The series follows many of the same beats as the film, while adding depth to the characters, such as the bubbly, outgoing Ginny Henningsen, whom Nick starts dating after leaving Anne. The close-knit pals initially rebuff her as the younger other woman, but come to discover someone patient, empathetic, and right for Nick at that stage of his life. She's a disruption to the friend group, but not an antagonist, Henningsen says. Between Ginny and Anne, you're given two compelling, interesting partners for Nick. The goal is that you walk away loving both these women. The show's candid, droll observations will be recognizable to anyone who has been in a long-term relationship. Many of us in the writer's room have known each other for 20 years, so everyone was very generous about sharing specifics of their relationships, says Faye, who has 2 daughters, Alice, 19, and Penelope, 13, with composer husband Jeff Richmond. Four Seasons proved cathartic for the 9-time Emmy winner who filmed the project last fall, mere months after she lost her mom, Jean, and Alice went off to college. It definitely kept me in the world because I could have been easily kept more and more in my house, Faye said. There are certain themes and topics in this that were a little too close to the bone, and it has been good for me to re-enter the world.
We'll read a few paragraphs from this column. Melissa Ruggieri's music column, headline, Morris Gets Sassy and Serious on New Album. Maren Morris is a few days past her to Divergent Coachella performances, a lovely My Church with the LA Philharmonic, and a lively The Middle with electropop DJ Zed, and she's still buzzing from the Desert Music Festival. Singing My Church with the orchestra, that was my first single and country hit. But you saw 10 years later the resonance it still had with the crowd, Morris says from Nashville. I always get emotional during that song, but with the choir and the setting at the Golden Hour when we performed, and then cut to the next night with Zed. A complete 180. We've had such a great friendship, so I don't feel as nervous. And the artists he brought up, John Mayer and Julia Michaels, are all my friends, so it was a celebratory night. And we'll have to stop there. You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Joe McFeeters and Kent Miner have been reading from USA Today. This broadcast is generously supported by The Forest at Duke. They can be reached at 800-474-0258. We thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are print blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast by going to our website, ncreadingservice.org. Please tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for our exercise program and at 9:30 a.m. for readings from the News and Observer. Up next is our feature program, broad drug and department store ads. Until then, we'll have segue announcements and music. Good evening.